Actu SF, les podcasts.
Bon, ben bonjour tout le monde. Nous sommes donc présents sur la salle Hetzel à la Cité des Congrès avec Christopher Priest qui est à ma droite. Je remplace au pied levé Pierre-Paul Durastanti qui visiblement est malade. Donc table ronde, cette discussion devait être centrée autour de la traduction et des difficultés de traduction d'un auteur comme Christopher Priest, qui est un auteur assez précis, qui a un univers particulier et qui n'appartient qu'à lui. Donc Pierre-Paul n'est pas là, je prends la relève, je ne suis pas traducteur, je suis éditeur. Donc j'ai été l'éditeur de Christopher Priest pendant 19 ans chez De Noël, où j'ai publié un certain nombre de ses livres, dont probablement le plus connu qui est Le Prestige, qui a été adapté au cinéma par Christopher Nolan. Et ce matin, nous allons discuter, donc, si vous voulez bien, des problèmes de traduction en français et peut-être dans les autres langues, de la spécificité de l'œuvre de Christopher Priest, qui est peut-être un domaine que je maîtrise mieux que les problèmes de traduction, et de son dernier livre, Conséquences d'une disparition, dont il parlera, je pense, qui n'est pas forcément un livre sur les attentats du 11 septembre, mais qui parle des attentats du 11 septembre, Chris.
Yes, it came out 2 months ago.
Voilà, sorti il y a 2 mois. Donc ma première question, Chris, quand on a eu une œuvre comme la vôtre maintenant, ça fait 40 ans, 50 ans que vous publiez des livres. Dans combien de langues avez-vous été traduit? Dans quel pays? À quel point l'œuvre de Christopher Priest est mondiale?
Well, I'm still trying to learn English, which is the start for every writer who writes in English. The total number of translations I worked out a few years ago was up to 23, but not all books are in all those languages. I don't have any problems with translations. I send them to the publisher and the book comes out a few weeks later. So.
Oui. Oui, ça marche. Tout le monde a la traduction, là? Ok. Donc, Chris, quelle est la langue la plus étonnante dans laquelle vous avez été traduit?
Well, that's interesting. I've been translated into Israeli, into Hebrew, and Korean, and recently into Mandarin Chinese. And all my life, I've been translated into Japanese. This is a mystery to me, because it seems to me my books are very Anglo-Euro-oriented and deal with things, not deliberately, but which are uniquely part of my culture. And yet the Japanese have always supported me and always published me and do well with my books. Great mystery to me. One book in particular, published here as, was it Nos Îlots Sombres? I wrote it about 45 years ago. It was immediately bought by the Japanese. They printed it, it stayed in print for 45 years. It's extraordinary to me. And yet the book is about a very narrow view of a particular kind of inhibited Englishman dealing with a global disaster. I never understood what the Japanese saw in it, but you can't anticipate these things.
Alors, je me souviens qu'il y a une quinzaine d'années, j'étais allé à Francfort négocier des droits de livres français. J'avais discuté avec des éditeurs japonais et coréens qui achetaient justement des livres qui étaient publiés par De Noël. Et la première chose qu'ils m'avaient dit, c'est que nous, ce qui nous intéresse, c'est d'avoir une vision de la France. C'est d'avoir des choses... voilà. Donc, je pense que pour eux, c'est très exotique et probablement qu'une apocalypse en Angleterre, c'est très exotique pour le peuple japonais.
Well, the weird thing is, of course, these days, the sort of catastrophe that was described in that novel is now a worldwide phenomenon of people literally escaping from their countries, walking away from their countries, or worse still, getting into badly made boats and trying to escape that way. That is what my novel was about. I remember the first really large phenomenon of that was at the end of the Vietnam War, when they were, in those days, called boat people, and thousands of Vietnamese tried to escape from Vietnam by boat with terrible disasters. I mean, a lot of people got killed trying that. And I don't know. I think the thing is, if you're interested in making your own country exotic, in other words, for other countries to learn by, I'm not sure that you can do that. I find that very difficult. I can only see my world, which I see as Anglo-European, through very straightforward eyes. I just look at it through the culture I know. I can't translate it into something that I think other people, other cultures might learn from.
Mais peut-être que le prisme de cette observation de la littérature, il est peut-être le secret, c'est peut-être justement que ces lecteurs étrangers, coréens, asiatiques, ce qu'ils cherchent, c'est une authenticité. Et que justement, comme vous baignez dans cette culture, vous êtes dans cette authenticité qu'ils trouvent comme nous quand on lit des romans de Mishima ou des romans de Kawabata. On se confronte à une littérature japonaise très ancrée dans la société japonaise.
Yes, that's interesting because I remember when I first discovered cinema as opposed to going to see films, the two countries I suddenly became aware of were Sweden through the films of Ingmar Bergman, and the Japanese through the films of memory's gone blank for a moment. And both of them...
Kurosawa, peut-être? Akira Kurosawa?
Yeah, Kurosawa, thank you. Yeah, sorry, brain died on me, as it often does these days. I'd always thought of Sweden as a fairly sort of normal Scandinavian country. And yet to see the films of Bergman at that young, impressionable age really opened my eyes to the fact that European culture is extremely diverse and that traditions are not shared any more than languages are shared. And certainly watching Japanese films, there was this kind of frisson of awareness that they were very like us in some ways, but had extremely different attitudes in others. And so I suppose the truth is that if I write about Britain or my version of Britain, then that becomes something which is a signal to readers abroad.
On va maintenant un petit peu se déplacer dans votre œuvre, Chris. Et je vous propose qu'on essaye de définir sa spécificité, ce qui va permettre de cerner les problèmes qu'elle pose au niveau de la traduction. Vous allez forcément me contredire, mais je pense que votre œuvre est basée sur les différences d'appréciation de l'observation et les différences dans la façon dont on perçoit la réalité.
There is no other subject. For me, the perception of reality is where I begin and end as a writer. This is because I've always had a very uncertain hold on reality. I'm never quite sure what is real. And whenever something is explained to me as something definitive, this is a definite description of something, the first thing I think is that can't be right. It can't be true. Nothing is as simple as that in life. And when you go into that, you realize that one's person's perception of reality is quite different from other people's. And I'm not talking now about culture. I'm talking about people you live next door to and the people you see in the street around you at home. These people seem to be like us, but they're all imagining something quite different. That, to me, is fascinating. And that for me, is a book.
Je pense à un livre en particulier où les personnages ont une forme d'invisibilité, qui est une forme d'invisibilité sociale, Ce livre-là, je me souviens, pour avoir travaillé sur la traduction, il était très compliqué à traduire parce qu'il y avait beaucoup de subtilités qui pouvaient être explicitées à la traduction, et donc ça changeait la nature du livre, ça changeait la nature du propos. Est-ce que vous êtes inquiet de que vos livres soient trahis quand ils sont traduits?
Well, I believe the words for translation and betrayal are quite similar in French, so I'm used to that. You talk about the glamour. That was for me an early adventure in the nature of reality. The novel is about invisible people. It's called. It used to be called Le Temps in French. It's now called Le Glamour. I think Gilles changed the title for some reason. I'm not quite sure why.
Oui, alors j'ai changé le titre parce que le. Je pense que vous pouvez expliquer, Chris, ce qu'est le glamour en fait. La racine du mot, la racine petit peu comment dire superstitieuse ou fantastique.
The word glamour of course now has an international meaning. We think of it as film stars or beautiful people or celebrities or fame or some kind of shining in some respect. In the original meaning of the word glamour is quite the opposite. It's a Scottish word. And it was glamour, and it was a kind of spell, and it was believed that if a young man met a young woman and he fell in love with her, and he didn't want other men to notice her, he would go to a witch or some kind of elder person in his village and buy a spell of glamour and put the glamour on her so that no other men could see her. Now, this is presumably a legend or a myth, but nevertheless, it's an interesting idea. And it explains why glamour is now the opposite of what people think. It's because presumably somebody who is glamorous was first of all invisible, but also very desirable. So it's an interesting word for me. The novel deals with people who are naturally invisible. There's some of them here this weekend. You probably haven't noticed them. They're quite normal looking, but they're very undistinguished. And they slip between the edges of reality. And they're quite real. They eat and they sleep and they have problems like us. But nobody ever notices them. And I thought about this quite a lot and realized this feeling of being invisible is something a lot of people share, you know, especially trying to get a drink in the bar and you're waiting and they don't catch your eye or you know this feeling of not being very noticeable and I just thought, what if there was a community of people who were so affected by this that in effect they had to survive as parasites in society. They had nowhere to live. They couldn't buy anywhere or rent anywhere, so they would have to go into hotels and find an empty room, or go to a department store where there were beds at night. They could never go to the doctor because they couldn't be treated, so they were all hypochondriac and they would go around with lots of pills which they would steal from pharmacies. And they all had terrible teeth because they could never go to a dentist. And I thought this was a very interesting way of looking at normal society through that prism of we're not noticed. We're here, but we're not noticed.
Souvent, dans la littérature, l'invisibilité, comme chez H.G. Wells, mais on peut remonter même à la République de Platon, c'est une forme de pouvoir. Et dans votre roman Glamour, il y a cette idée que c'est quelque part une malédiction, puisque ces gens traversent nos vies sans être remarqués. Mais ils ont aussi un pouvoir sur les gens. Ils peuvent habiter les maisons, alors qu'il y a des gens qui habitent là. Ils peuvent s'installer chez les gens sans qu'on les remarque et occuper d'espèces d'interstices vacants dans nos vies. C'est une idée très perturbante, je trouve.
I think it's quite the opposite, actually, Gilles. I think around the time The Glamour was published, several other books came out, but three or four novels about invisibility from America. And they all had this idea that invisibility was power, that it gave you the freedom to do things that you couldn't be stopped from doing because nobody would notice you. But I found that was quite wrong. Even Wells, in his novel The Invisible Man, his kind of invisibility was actual. There was some kind of scientific treatment that I can't remember how he did it, but he was made physically invisible. But he couldn't wear clothes, so he had to walk around naked. If he didn't want to be seen, he had to be naked. And in living in Britain in winter is not funny if you can't wear clothes. And so he was very much a vulnerable person, and he ended up very much as a victim. He wasn't. People were frightened of him, but in fact, it's like being frightened of an animal that bares its teeth at you. The animal isn't going to attack you; it's baring its teeth at you because it's frightened, and he was frightened. But the American books were all about going into shower rooms and watching women have baths and things, and it was kind of, I thought, really superficial and hadn't really thought through the idea of invisibility.
Donc l'invisibilité pose avant tout une question morale.
Well, it's really a psychological problem. It's the question is, I paralleled it. I made it into a metaphor for forgetting. The central character of the Glamour opens the book, the time when he's lost his memory. There's been an accident of some kind, and he's suffering from amnesia. And this was something that happened to me when I was a child. I was involved in an accident, and I lost my memory. And I had no memory of the accident itself, which I suppose is a kind of way for the body to protect you from trauma. But also, very weirdly, I had retroactive amnesia. I couldn't remember 3 or 4 weeks before the accident. In fact, I never recovered those memories. I have no idea what happened. I assume, as I was a 12-year-old boy, my life was very ordinary. I went to school and, you know, that sort of very dull things like that. But even so, that hole in my memory puzzled me and intrigued me for weeks. And in fact, I've never recovered those memories. Now they're irrelevant, but at the time it was a very strong traumatic feeling. And it seemed to me that in those weeks that I'd forgotten, the ones where they'd gone from me, I'd been alive, I'd been there, I'd done things, I'd made decisions, I'd touched things, eaten things, talked to people, said things, and yet those actions no longer existed. They'd become invisible. They were part of a past that I couldn't claim because I can no longer remember it. And so invisibility in the Glamour is very much connected with the idea of short and long-term memory and short and long-term forgetting.
Dans l'archipel du rêve, Dream Archipelago, il y a une nouvelle où le narrateur ou la narratrice est indéterminé pendant très longtemps. On ne sait pas si c'est un homme ou une femme. Est-ce que vous, quand vous écrivez, vous vous demandez, vous vous posez la question, est-ce que ça va être difficile à traduire ou est-ce que ça va poser des problèmes de traduction ou est-ce que vous en foutez, juste vous écrivez?
Well, of course, there's one particular story Gilles is talking about where the gender of the narrator is concealed, or at least just not revealed, until close to the end of the story. And I remember thinking, because English as a language is not gender-based. There are no genders to nouns or adjectives. And so it's very easy to conceal this in English. And I did wonder how it was going to be translated. In fact, I've never actually had the answer. Do you know what the translator did with that story?
Oui, oui, ben, c'est Michel Charrier qui a traduit le texte et elle s'en est très, très bien tirée. Donc elle a dû un petit peu adapter le texte en contournant certains adjectifs et en remaniant certaines phrases. Mais en effet, on ne sait pas avant la fin si c'est un narrateur ou une narratrice. Et quand on le découvre, c'est un choc, quoi. On est vraiment surpris parce que depuis le début de la nouvelle, on pense que le personnage est exactement du sexe opposé de celui qu'on va découvrir, en fait. C'est ça qui est très fort.
Yes. Well, I'm glad to hear that because Michelle translated many of my books, and I always thought she was a very excellent translator. And I'm very glad to hear that. Also, I felt a bit guilty because French isn't the only language in which gender is identified by the language, and so I'm sure it's caused problems for translators all over the place. But,
Oui, c'est actuellement en science-fiction, on voit beaucoup de romans où la question des genres est centrale. On voit ça chez Anne Leckie, on voit ça chez Sam G. Miller par exemple ou d'autres auteurs. Et c'est vrai qu'on voit que les traducteurs et les traductrices s'arrachent les cheveux parce que quand les personnages sont neutres ou quand les personnages sont non binaires ou ne veulent pas être déterminés par un genre, masculin ou féminin. En français, il n'y a pas de neutre, donc il faut trahir. Voilà, pour revenir à la discussion. Chris, j'aimerais, avec votre accord, qu'on parle de votre dernier livre, peut-être, puisque c'est votre actualité. Est-ce que vous pouvez nous le présenter ? Donc, en français, c'est « Conséquences d'une disparition ». Et je crois que c'est de nouveau aussi un livre sur la mémoire.
Yeah, it's called An American Story in England. In France, it's called Consequences d'une Disparition. Both titles are relevant. They're both actual. They describe the novel very well. An American Story, it's about the story of 9/11. It's not about 9/11. It's about the way the story has been told. The general idea for me was that 9/11, the events of 9/11, the disaster, was an international experience. More than 110 countries lost people that day. And subsequently, I mean, we're about now 17 years later, nearly a million people have died as a more or less direct result of that day, all over the world. So it's an international disaster. But the Americans tell the story. They because they say it's an American event, which I don't agree with, that they have the right to say what happened that day. And they created a congressional investigation into what happened. And two or three years after the event, the congressional report was released. If you read that report, the first thing you find is there's massive conflicts of logic in that the people who were on the committee had all sorts of vested interests. The committee wasn't given enough money. They weren't allowed to interview relevant people such as the president or the secretary of defense. They weren't allowed to go on site. It was all done through self-appointed witnesses coming forward. So it's a completely unreliable document. One of the major omissions in it was the collapse of what's called Building 7, which was the third building to collapse in New York that day. It's not even mentioned in the congressional report how that happened. And that was... So at that point, you think that the story is suspect. And in later years, people, often in America, but all around the world, have said, look, this isn't right. What really did happen? The wall of silence comes down. There is absolutely no way you can get anything more out of the authorities. If you make a freedom of information request to, for example, the FBI about their activities at the time, their answer is always, there has been a congressional report, we cannot add to that or move away from it. So it's a wall of silence. And I think there's an interest... For me, there's all sorts of interest in here. One is the actual one. Like everybody else, I saw what happened that day, horrified by it. And then you think, what the hell was going on? And when the story comes, you think, yeah, okay, that may be what happened. But as soon as you look at the story in detail, there are endless problems. For example, there is no CCTV from the airports of the hijackers, alleged hijackers, getting on the aircraft. They somehow found the only airports in the USA which don't have cameras on the departure gates. So, and at that point, you say, well, why? I mean, how did that happen? What's going on? Who's got the tapes? Why aren't they being released? So that's just the beginning. There's lots of mysteries like that. So that interests me as a member of the human race. But as a novelist, I love the idea of a story telling a lie, because that, you start wondering, now that's interesting to me, because the whole idea of memory is very much bound up with narrative. When we remember things, we tend to remember them as a story. We say, oh, something happened to me last year, and it's very interesting, and you tell the story of what happened. And in telling a story, you are fabricating, you're making fiction, you are telling a story. And the 9/11 world has one of the best and worst stories I've ever come across.
Est-ce que vous n'avez pas l'impression que c'est très américain, cette histoire de prendre des faits et de faire du storytelling avec, de changer peut-être, pas forcément les faits, mais les présenter de façon à ce que ça change l'impression qu'on en a. Je pensais tout simplement à L'homme qui tue à Liberty Valance, qui est un western, qui est un classique, où à un moment, un des personnages dit ben, la légende est plus belle que les faits, imprimer la légende, mais ce qui est imprimé, c'est ce qui reste. Donc, on est toujours... C'est marrant, c'est peut-être parce qu'il y a cette particularité un peu américaine, ancienne, que la théorie du complot s'est tellement développée aux États-Unis, parce qu'ils ont un peu ça dans leur histoire commune.
Sorry, it's taking a while to come through. I'm not sure about that. I don't think you can generalize about American people, American culture, as having certain attributes. It's a highly sophisticated society, highly diverse. Every level of, even in these terrible days of Trump, there's still a wide spectrum of opinion and thought in America. I think my own theory of 9/11 is that it was a fuck-up. That they made a big mistake, and they started lying about it, and in the way of lies, they just got bigger and bigger. I don't know what happened. I don't know how it happened. There are too many mysteries for me to solve. But I like the idea of a kind of society sitting on its secrets and... hoping nobody will notice, whereas in fact we do notice, and we feel very critical. I think the lack of science interested me. One of the things you find out if you start investigating 9/11 is that the science is all wrong. That you've probably heard the theory that the buildings were demolished and not knocked down by aircraft, and if you go into the science, the engineering of how steel buildings are made and how they're designed and how they are intended to behave if something like an aircraft hits it, you realize that what we saw on that day, what we saw in the films and the TV, it wasn't what we were told it was. The buildings weren't collapsing. They can't collapse in that way. They're physically unable to. And so, and then... Like the aircraft, we saw those aircraft whizzing in and hitting the buildings. The fact is that no normal airliners can fly that fast, that low. When you're on the plane, it comes into land, it slows down. It doesn't slow down because it's got to sort of land carefully. It slows down because if it goes too fast in dense air, it will the plane will be damaged. That the there's lots of wind tunnel tests showing this on aircraft, that once you go above about 200 or 300 miles an hour in thick air, the actual fabric of the aircraft becomes unsafe, and there's film of aircraft breaking up because they're going too fast. And yet we saw at least two aircraft going across New York at sea level at about 600 miles an hour, or about 450 kilometers an hour. That is actually physically impossible. So what did we see? And so if you look at the science, you find out, and you ask widely, you discover that there are aircraft in America which are strengthened, which will allow you to fly very slow, very fast. But they're all military aircraft. Take it or leave it. What do you believe?
Et vous nous direz pas quelle est votre théorie alors?
Well, I said it's a cock-up. I think it was one of the things that you find out is on the day of 9/11, they were planning an exercise which they did regularly with the North American Air Defense, where they would send aircraft up to pretend to be hijacked aircraft entering American airspace, and then the NORAD people would send up fighters to intercept them. And they had one of these exercises planned that day. And in fact, some of the aircraft were in the air at the time. And when the, as it were, real hijacks began, the air traffic controllers were very confused. And in fact, these tapes exist. This is not imaginary. They're saying, is this real? Or is this the test? Is this the exercise? And somebody says, no, no, it's an exercise. Carry on. And then 2 minutes later, somebody will say, but there's another one now. Is this the exercise or is this real? And it takes them about 5 or 10 minutes to realize this is really happening. And you sort of think, that's not a very good defense system. You know, they spend billions of dollars on defending America from exactly this thing. And on the one day it was tested, it failed completely. That's embarrassing. That's really embarrassing to politicians, to defense analysts, to people who run armies and air forces. And I think that's a beginning to how this whole project became very secretive, very full of people refusing to tell the truth.
Est-ce que vous avez conscience que c'est une thèse qui peut choquer, heurter les gens?
I don't try to shock. But I tell you what, nobody in America, no publisher in America will touch it. I haven't sold it in America at all. I've sold all my other books in America. And after several weeks, my publisher in the UK, who handled the rights, sent me an Excel spreadsheet with all the reactions on from these editors. And they all said the same thing. It was quite interesting. There were basically three sentences. The first sentence said, oh, we really admire the work of Christopher Priest, a marvelous novelist, brilliant, fantastic, you know, loved everything he's ever written. That's the first sentence. The second sentence said, but I think in this book he's really gone wrong. It's very slow and it's quite long and it's very boring and didn't really convince me. That was the second sentence. The third sentence was, but it's about 9/11, which we can't publish. It's part of the problem. You see, the media in America, and including publishers, are clearly craven to this, that they're losing their sense of independence. And I feel quite strongly about this because, I mean, for one thing, I need the money from selling to America. I'm not getting that money. So, okay, I'll get by. But it's a freedom of speech issue. America is very strong on freedom of speech. They hold it as this great holy writ. And yet, this is the country that is actually preventing anyone reading my book.
Peut-être parler un petit peu de l'avenir. Qu'est-ce que vous écrivez actuellement? Qu'est-ce que vous nous préparez après le 11 septembre?
10/12. I don't know. Well, I was. You've heard of my novel, The Prestige, Le Prestige, and this was sold to Hollywood. And as you know, they made a film of it. They sent me a contract, and the contract's about this thick. It took me about a day to read it. It's written by American lawyers. It's disgusting. It's full of self-centered protection from people like me making money out of their film. But one of the clauses in this contract was that I could never write anything about anything that was called The Prestige. I couldn't write a sequel. I couldn't use the characters again. I couldn't in any way make use of the book I'd written as an ongoing project. And I sort of understand that, but I think a word like prestige is a good word. It's something which I feel I should be able to use. And so I was kind of annoyed. And then I started thinking about, one day I'm going to write a book about magic and sort of do it differently so that they don't find out, or the lawyers who wrote that contract have lost their jobs and will never read it. And so I started learning about the world of magic in France about 100 years ago, which was quite interesting because there was a renaissance of performing magic. I'm talking about stage magic, not supernatural magic. And it coincided with a time which in France is called Les Années Folles, which is seen by Americans and British as the period of the lost generation, when writers like Fitzgerald and Hemingway came to France, lived in Paris, and created some kind of culture. And then I started thinking, well, maybe that's not entirely true. And I did some more research, and I discovered that at that period, at any one time during the 1920s, 100 years ago, there was something between 15 and 20,000 Americans permanently resident in Paris. And none of these were artists or photographers or novelists. They were American businessmen. They were people who were rich, a lot of them were fleeing from prohibition. They didn't like not being able to drink, so they came to Europe where they could drink freely. And also the rate of exchange was extremely advantageous to Americans. And it had all sorts of problems. I mean, one was that it was very difficult to find anywhere to live in Paris. All the apartments were taken. All the hotels were full. A lot of the restaurants had to start selling hot dogs and hamburgers. And in fact, I was in Paris last month, and I discovered almost every restaurant I went to is still selling hamburgers, which is, to me, slightly shocking in France. Anyway, I thought there's probably a novel in this. So I was in Paris to research this, and I thought the combination of these footloose Americans and a resurgence in stage magic, and for me, an interest in the work of Jules Verne, which is something I've always found quite interesting, would produce a cocktail that would make a novel. So it's very different from the 9/11 book, but I have yet to finish it.
Mais les années 20 en France, c'est pas surtout et avant tout les conséquences de la Première Guerre mondiale qui a été probablement pour la France l'entrée véridique dans le XXe siècle.
Well, the French were having a hard time, yeah. And I mean, they'd lost millions of men. It was a very, very bad time. Paris had been bombarded with shells, a lot of damage there. And it was a time of very poor housing. It wasn't the Paris we know now, or there were vestiges of it. There were clues to what it would be and stay. But it was not at that time a sort of an international major city, which it is now.
Dans plusieurs de vos romans, vous mettez en scène des personnages historiques réels. Je pense à La Séparation, par exemple, où il est question de Churchill, ou dans L'Adjacent, où on voit H.G. Wells, si je me souviens bien. Est-ce que dans ce nouveau roman, il y aura des personnages historiques que vous mettez en scène?
No, it's all fiction. I mean, I have a joke about Ernest Hemingway. I sort of think that Ernest Hemingway is somebody that you have a duty to make jokes about. And but other than that, it's all fiction. The only real person who features in it is Jules Verne, who is at that time long dead.
Ce sera un personnage mort.
He's a living dead character, yes.
Okay. Is your first zombie novel?
Sorry?
C'est votre premier roman de zombie.
No, but my first zombie novel is actually The Prestige. It's not in the film, but the end of The Prestige novel is quite different from the film.
Ça c'est les joies d'Hollywood.
Well, I like the film of The Prestige. I sort of it came out a lot better than I thought it would, and I think it's got. If you haven't seen the film, I do recommend it. It's quite. I've seen it several times in cinemas. Obviously, I have to go and see it a lot. Almost every time I see it, when you come out of the theatre, you know, there's people going down the stairs, and you're with them, and they're talking about the film, and they always take it very seriously. They talk about the film in serious terms. What did that mean? They say. What do you think that intended? Also, audiences watch the film in silence. They don't laugh or titter or move around or get up and change seats or whatever. They sit there completely wrapped up in the film, which I find very interesting. It's very a thinking film. But then visually, it's excellent too. And I think it's actually, as Gilles said, it was made by Christopher Nolan, who's made himself famous with a lot of films. I think they're terrible, actually. I think the Prestige and his first film, Memento, are his two best films. And since then, he's really swallowed the pill of Hollywood and likes spending money and doing films full of effects. And the thinking side of Nolan has been suppressed.
Merci. On va peut-être prendre des questions du public, s'il y en a. Oui, il y a des questions dans le public. Levez la main.
Bonjour. Philippe, simple terrien. J'aimerais savoir, quand vous êtes traduit, est-ce que vous avez un droit de relecture au cas où il y ait, vous avez parlé de la Chine, par exemple, tout à l'heure, des risques de censure ?
About translation and how I feel it. I can read French. I can't speak French, but I can read French well enough to be able to follow a translation of my books. The translations I've been blessed with in France seem always to me to be very accurate. I don't know how good they are stylistically. I have to depend on other people, French speakers, to tell me if the style is good. I believe Michel Charrier is an extremely good translator, and Jacques Collin, my current translator, is as good. So French is a special thing for me. But if I see a book in Indonesian, I can't translate that. I don't even know where to start. I don't know how a Japanese book looks, or a Chinese book, or indeed a book in Hebrew. And so you have to take on trust the fact that it is being translated. Normally, we have a clause in the contract that the translation will be full and faithful, and that it should reflect the nature of the book rather than anything else. But we're very much in the hands of the publisher and the translator. The one country that used to cut books and change them was, of all places, Germany. I used to see my books, and sometimes a long book would come in, and it was actually now a short book, and it had a title which didn't mean anything, and I would see whole chapters missing. And it's very difficult to know what to do at that point. You can't sort of, how can you complain? But I suppose in a regime like China, I don't know, I can't comment on that. I assume that the people who work in publishing are motivated to publish books for the same reason as publishers everywhere. But there are state rules and state precedents in China that I don't understand, and if I know of them, I don't like the sound of them. And so I therefore assume that books are subject at least to examination in a way which wouldn't be true in the West. I did have some books published years ago, many years ago, in the Soviet Union. I had two novels published, and at this time it was quite difficult getting books published in Russia. And one of the novelties was that it was printed about 100,000 copies. They sold them on the same day. If only you could do that in France, you know, fantastic. And then one day I got a letter from a reader living in England who was a Russian emigre. And he said, I've just read your novel in Russian, and there's an essay at the back. Are you aware of what it says? And I said, no. And so he said, I will translate it for you and send it to you. And it was a long essay. It was about 20, 30 pages. And the novel was the novel known in France as Le Monde Inverti. And this 20-page essay justified the novel in terms of Leninist Marxism. And it was quite an extraordinary event, you know, that somehow they were publishing a book, and as far as I could see, they didn't touch it, you know, they didn't hurt it, but they sort of had to explain it in ideological terms. And this idea of explaining literature is, to me, completely anathema. Literature is an art form. It stands or it falls on itself. If it's any good, it's any good. If it's not any good, it's not any good. Those are the standards. We don't want some bloody bureaucrat in some office looking at it and giving it an approval.
Une autre question dans le public? Ah, n'hésitez pas. Hein.
Come on. No. Oh.
C'est bien.
Oui, en fait, on m'entend là? Oui. Par rapport à la traduction, j'ai lu récemment la version poche de The Gradual, qui est et je l'ai lu en français, sous le titre français de L'inclinaison. Et je n'ai pas compris. Bon, la traduction me paraît tout juste autant que. Mais ce que je n'ai pas compris, c'est que dans le texte du roman, The Gradual est traduit par Le Graduel. Et du coup, je me suis interrogée sur la pertinence de ne pas avoir gardé la traduction exacte, précise, Le Graduel, qui est employé partout dans le texte pour le titre également.
Yeah. Je vais répondre.
My friend here will explain.
Donc c'est ma faute. C'est ma très grande faute. Quand on a travaillé sur la traduction avec Jacques Collin, on s'est rendu compte autour de nous que personne, mais quand je dis personne, hein, personne ne savait ce qu'était le graduel, ne comprenait le mot, et etc., etc. Alors, tout à l'heure, Chris disait que la littérature, c'est de l'art, ça tombe tout seul ou ça tient tout seul. On est quand même, quand on est éditeur, obligé à un moment ou à un autre de réfléchir aux problématiques de commercialisation et aux problématiques commerciales. Et il fallait trouver un titre pour ce roman. Les romans de Christopher Priest ont des titres qui ne sont pas toujours faciles une fois traduits en français. Autant Le Monde Averti, c'est absolument génial. Autant l'adjacent, ça marche. Autant des choses sont compliquées. Et Le Gradual, c'était très compliqué. Donc on a essayé de trouver quelque chose avec... avec Jacques Collin, et on est parti sur l'idée que le roman glissait, qu'il y avait des problématiques temporelles. Pour ceux qui l'ont lu, c'est un roman où le temps ne se passe pas de la même façon selon les endroits. Et on réfléchissait aussi à la couverture, une espèce de couverture qui glisse, une espèce de pente. Et on s'est mis d'accord à peu près tout le monde dans la maison de Noël sur l'inclinaison, qui n'est pas un titre fidèle, j'en ai tout à fait conscience, mais par contre qui est un titre que je trouvais d'une façon oblique, rappeler Glissement de temps de Philippe K. Dick, ou rappeler des idées que les choses glissent et que le temps n'est pas forcément quelque chose de linéaire et d'horizontal. Et c'est un peu comme la démocratie, c'est le moins pire de tous les systèmes, mais en fait c'est le meilleur. Et on n'a pas trouvé mieux que l'inclinaison. Désolé, c'est ma faute.
Yeah, it's quite an obscure word in English. It has a meaning of slow movement, but it's also a form of music. And the central character is a musician, composer, and at one point he's actually commissioned to write a gradual for a religious body who wanted, and it's a lot of a gradual in religious music is a kind of slow, celebratory, rather sad piece of music. It's quite short, but because of that, it seemed to me to fit the title of the book. But when Gilles said what he said, effectively the same thing to me 2 or 3 years ago, I took the point entirely, and but titles are so, I mean, titles are so problematical. They're so important. You know, people identify the book by the title forever. And you want it to be memorable, you want it to be true, you want it to be interesting. You know, you want it, so it's sometimes you just can't get it right.
Peut-être une dernière question. Une dernière question au public ? Non, c'est bon. Ben, nous vous remercions pour votre attention.
Thank you to the translator.